Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. We have the privilege of consulting from time to time with a man who has made an outsized contribution to the war for the free world over the years in a variety of capacities, including as an Army officer, as well as a CIA clandestine service veteran, and at the agency during his career serving as the Weapons of Mass Destruction Terrorism Office Director. He has also run for Congress. He has written numerous books, a Renaissance man. A personal favorite of mine is Beyond Repair, The Decline and Fall of the CIA. His name, of course, is Charles Sam Faddis, and we're delighted, as always, to have him. Sam, thank you for taking a few minutes to join us today. Sam, at And Magazine, which I'm very grateful to you for allowing me to publish a piece at last week about Larry Fink of BlackRock, you have been doing some terrific writing and reporting, and I was very interested in a piece that you had there recounting what happened to you in connection with a post of a link to an article that appeared actually on another platform, one of my other favorites, Breitbart. Give us a sense of this story and what it suggests about what the tech giants are doing more generally in this moment of crisis and pandemic.
Right. Well, as you indicated, I posted a link to an article that was published on Breitbart. I posted it on a political website in Pennsylvania where I happen to reside. And the article basically concerned Governor Whitmer in Michigan and how she has backtracked and changed her position on the use of chloroquine or its derivatives to treat the coronavirus. And then I'm made aware within less than 24 hours by the administrator of the site, of the Facebook page, actually, that I posted this on, that the fact checkers Facebook have appeared and served notice that they have designated this article as fake news. I think they used false news. And they are now going to post some sort of notice on the page saying that this is, in effect, lies, posting links to some other article that they claim is correct, and then threatening pretty directly that if there are continued transgressions of this type, they will limit the distribution of your posts. They will essentially start taking your voice away. So I then subsequently wrote an article for And Magazine where I laid all this out and then dove into all of the facts that established conclusively that Governor Whitmer did exactly what she was accused of by Breitbart and has been accused of by many other people. She took a position contrary to President Trump on chloroquine for political reasons, no other reason, and then very rapidly was forced to face the fact that, inconveniently for her, the drug actually works and may save one heck of a lot of lives. And now the thought police brother has to come in and sanitize the record, of course. We can't have the potential future vice presidential candidate of the Democratic Party having been seen to have opposed the use of a drug which will save many lives. So we will now go back straight out of 1984 and Orwell's imagination and sanitize the record such that it never occurred.
It's kind of like those pictures of Leon Trotsky in the old Soviet photographs who, you know, was simply excised from the prominent role that he played at the time because he fell from power. So, Sam Faddis, you've written this piece. You have laid out what actually happened. Have the fact checkers now come back and rehabilitated you or otherwise apologized for getting it wrong and, well, defaming, I guess, is one way of putting it, and certainly threatening to censor you?
They have not, although I will note that I saw online the other day that Facebook had been forced to come out publicly and retract the same kind of accusation they had made against Breitbart in regard to a different article. They had to admit publicly to Breitbart that in this other case their fact checkers were wrong. I mean, I'm all for forceful opinions, as anybody who reads my stuff knows. I'm also all for standing on a firm foundation. I do my research before I write. The idea that somebody who probably left school 5 minutes ago is announcing to me that I'm lying, you know, is absolutely infuriating. When I was talking to a friend about this, they likened this to some sort of theocracy, and I thought that was a great word. My real offense is I did not go with the dogma.
You've deviated. You've engaged in apostasy. And I mean, to this point, Sam Faddis, as I mentioned at the outset in introducing you, you have a record of accomplishment. You're a serious hombre. We're dealing with a universe of people. Maybe they've just gotten out of school. Maybe they're, you know, relatively inexperienced. They certainly seem to have a political agenda. And you're not the only one who's been subjected to this kind of treatment or censorship. And I guess the question to you is, what recourse do you have? You know, I myself have been sullied, as you know, over the years. And the question that, where do I go to get my reputation back? What's your response to this? What recourse is there? What recourse should there be at the minimum?
Well, I think the short version is, you know, keep fighting. I mean, in this case, my immediate response was, okay, you want to talk about this? Here you go. I mean, I cut and pasted into my article about half of the notice that the governor wrote, where she threatened every physician and basically pharmacist in the state of Michigan, and it's crystal clear it had to do with chloroquine. So you want to talk facts, let's do that. I think beyond that, at certain points, like we saw with those high school students who were defamed on the mall, I think it is completely appropriate in some circumstances to take these people to court. I mean, there are laws on slander and libel, and if you're going to, as they did with these high school kids, just make up a story and destroy those kids, really, maybe you ought to face some serious consequences. Maybe when you're paying millions of dollars, you'll start thinking about writing truth.
Yeah, well, you're the attorney, of course. You've served as an assistant attorney general in Washington State, so I would defer to you on this. But what I've been given to understand is that these social media platforms, unlike the Washington Post and some other mainstream publications, have basically got, you know, statutory immunity from being sued, no matter how outrageous their conduct is. That's something that needs to be addressed and a subject for a further conversation with you, I hope, soon. But Sam Faddis, in the meantime, thank you for your truth-telling, as well as for your appearances on this program to help us understand the efforts of people to prevent the truth from being told. It's vitally important that we correct this. We appreciate you so much, my friend. Come back to us again very soon, if you would. Next up, we'll speak with Gordon Chang. We'll take stock with him about the latest on the coronavirus, that and more straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. It's time for our weekly visit with one of the greatest authorities in our country when it comes to matters involving China and our vital interests, well, that are being imperiled by China most days. His name, of course, is Gordon Chang. He is the author of three terrific books, The Coming Collapse of China, Nuclear Showdown, North Korea Takes on the World, and Losing South Korea. You can find his writings in the right places, The Daily Beast and National Interest, National Review. He is a great resource, especially for this program. We're always delighted to have him with us and encourage you to follow him on Twitter at Gordon G. Chang. We do. Gordon, welcome back. It's so good to have you with us. Let me ask you, you've just published a new piece about what China is doing with its propaganda narrative. My colleague Michael Waller at the Center for Security Policy has done a terrific job of chronicling this in a timeline that's available at securefreedom.org. But I commend to people your new piece at the Gatestone Institute entitled China's Fake News, Its, quote, Superior System, unquote, Defeats Virus. Walk us through. I've been sort of characterizing this as, my paraphrase, communism is a cure for coronavirus. It ain't necessarily so, is it?
No, it certainly isn't. China is about to suffer a second wave of coronavirus infections. And even the Communist Party media says that this new wave appears inevitable. We're starting to see evidence of this across the country, Frank, but especially in Shanghai. In Shanghai, they have closed tourist attractions that were open just a week before. So, for instance, the observation deck on Shanghai Tower, which is China's tallest building, the nearby Oriental Pearl Tower, the Jinmao Tower, these have been closed. About 25 other tourist attractions have been shuttered. And this is a real indication that Chinese authorities are concerned about this new wave of infections. In addition to all of this, Beijing, at the end of March on the 27th, closed all theaters across China, which it just had opened the week before. So there is something going on, Frank, because if Beijing were confident, it certainly would not be taking these actions.
So, Gordon, in addition to these tourist attractions, there must be a similar concern about the factories that the Chinese government has reportedly, sometimes forcibly, required workers to return to, many forced to live in crowded dormitories on the site. Would you anticipate seeing those facilities shut down as well?
Yeah, there are reports of workers coming back to their job sites and reinfecting each other. So, for instance, in Dongguan, which is the industrial heart of industrial Guangdong province in the south, their workers came back with the disease. And that means that those that they've been in contact with have had to be quarantined. And as you point out, in many of these factories, the living quarters, people are very close to each other. So Xi Jinping had really wanted to get the country back to work. This is a program that he started at the first week of February when disease was ravaging China. So he's been successful in getting people back to their jobs. But, you know, Frank, the problem for Xi Jinping is that he's got an export-heavy economy. His two primary export markets, Europe and the U.S., are flat on their back, which means that they're just not selling anything. Factories are open, but they're not producing. And that is something that he can't overcome. Just to give you one example of this, TJ Maxx, the big box U.S. retailer, 2 weeks ago canceled all open orders, about $1.5 billion worth of them, most of them going to China. This is the new reality for Beijing.
So, Gordon, one of the things that is being bounced around the internet, and there's talk about fake news, there's all kinds of stuff there, but it's speculation that what we have been subjected to here actually emanated from a biological warfare facility in Wuhan, which had been experimenting with bat-derived coronaviruses, perhaps samples of which were obtained from the Canadian Institute of Microbiology in Winnipeg, and that perhaps what the Chinese actually have done here was unleash this on us, at least unintentionally, if not intentionally. And they may have a vaccine for this virus, as well as, you know, having perfected the virus itself. One of the reasons that I wanted to talk with you about all this today was that the Chinese have, of course, been cooking the books on the numbers of people who've been affected. I think everybody understands that, including now even the U.S. intelligence community, amazingly. One of the most stunning of those statistics from the Chinese government has been that the People's Liberation Army has apparently had no individuals in the army infected with this disease. Tell us what you make of all of that information, or at least assertions, and how you square the circle between what's going on at the moment in places like Beijing and Shanghai and some of those explanatory ideas?
Well, first of all, with regard to the People's Liberation Army, I don't believe that they have no infections. You have to remember that at the height of the epidemic in Wuhan, Beijing brought in the PLA and health workers and the rest of it. As we can see from every other country where this virus has hit, health workers have been particularly affected. So I don't think that China was able to be the only country in the world where there were no infections in the military doctors and nurses who came in. So it's sort of like a baseline. With regard to Beijing and Shanghai, there, I believe, have been clusters of cases in both of those cities. And indeed, the closure of venues indicates that Beijing thinks that there were indeed a possibility of a real big second wave. If we go back to January, the modeling of virologists said that the epidemic would peak in China in the April to May timeframe, and it would peak in places in the east, and particularly Shanghai was mentioned in connection with this. So this disease, I think, is probably now about to start in a big way in the eastern part of the country. We've seen in the U.S., coronavirus has gone from city to city. It's doing the same thing in China as well. You know, we can't think. I mean, it's just impossible to believe that this virus is much less transmissible and much less lethal in China than it's been in every other place in the world.
Unless one credits this idea that maybe they have a vaccine, but you don't credit that. Is that right?
Yeah, I don't think we have evidence showing that. You know, it's always possible. But if there were a vaccine, I think we probably would have heard about it because China is pretty leaky in this regard. But, you know, clearly, you know, when you talk about what's going on in those P4 biosafety labs in Wuhan, you have to be very concerned about what's going on there. And we do not know because as we've seen over the last week, the idea that this was an accidental release from a biosafety lab there is gaining currency. And you don't hear people say, as you did a week ago, oh, it's just a conspiracy theory. Now there's a lot of science that actually backs that up.
We will follow this closely, needless to say. Gordon, two other things before we have to let you go. One is I wanted to get your take on the growing evidence that the Chinese exploitation of this outbreak to flood the world with masks and test kits and the like, which turn out to be in very substantial numbers defective, is presumably going to be a bit of a problem for China. It's obviously a problem for the countries that have spent good money trying to protect their healthcare workers and others. Your thoughts on that?
Well, especially in Europe, Frank, China has blackened its reputation by, first of all, saying these were donations when they were in reality sales, but also the high inaccuracy rates, such as the ones in the Czech Republic and elsewhere, really point to defective Chinese manufacturing in general, a problem we've known about before. So China's clearly blackened its reputation with regard to its masks, protective equipment, and its diagnostic kits.
Let me turn to one last topic quickly. Gordon, the United Nations, in its infinite wisdom, has appointed China to a seat on the United Nations Human Rights Council, which has been a rogue's gallery for decades under both this incarnation and a previous one. Talk a little bit about the absurdity, if not really the obscenity, of such a role for China under the circumstances, especially the present.
The appointment of China to the Human Rights Council is an indication that multilateralism has completely failed. The United Nations was meant to promote human rights, and now we have the biggest enemy of human rights sitting at the center of its efforts in this regard. We see, for instance, China has taken the World Health Organization and turned it into an organization that has actually promoted this disease. It's just, after this is over, after the virus subsides, the U.S. needs to have a national conversation on our relationship with the U.N., because obviously the U.N. is broken. It's now like the League of Nations, and it's going to go the same way.
Except in the case of the United Nations, it is going the same way under the dominant power of China, it seems, agency after agency, and now this council. We'll talk more about that in the future, too. Gordon, as always, I appreciate your visits with us. I encourage once again our audience to follow you at Gordon G. Chang on Twitter, and also check out his terrific works, particularly my personal favorite, The Coming Collapse of China. We'll talk with you soon. Thanks so much, my friend. Next up, we will speak with Douglas Feith about what the coronavirus portends for, well, the world order, among other things, right after this.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. I'm especially pleased to welcome back to these microphones our dear friend and colleague of many years, Douglas J. Feith. He has served his country in a number of important capacities, including most recently as the Undersecretary of Defense for Policy, 4 years during the George W. Bush administration. 4 extraordinarily eventful and consequential years, I think it's fair to say, which he has documented as well as anyone in a terrific book about the period, entitled War and Decision. These days, Doug Feith is a senior fellow and the director of the Center for National Security Strategies at the Hudson Institute, and always a welcome guest here. Doug Feith, welcome back. It's so good to have you. I guess I'd like to get your thoughts, Doug, at a moment when we are primarily looking at China through the prism of the, well, I call it the Chinese Communist Party virus that it unleashed on the world. More generally, as a historian and strategist of renown, what should we be thinking about what the Chinese Communists are up to and how best to contend with it?
Well, one of the major challenges that the Chinese have posed to us is how we think about, at one and the same time, protecting ourselves as a national security matter from the threats that China poses, and on the other hand, conducting business with them because they are one of the major players in international economics. And this is a challenge that is different from the challenge that we had with the Soviet Union during the Cold War, because the Soviets never had the place in world trade and investment that the Chinese have. And the Chinese government has a policy of exploiting all of their commercial relations for military purposes. And they're very open about this. They've even given the policy a name. It's called the Military-Civilian Fusion Policy. And there's a commission to oversee the fusion of military and civilian activities. And that commission is personally chaired by Xi Jinping, the president of China. So this is a very high priority item. And it's a major challenge for businessmen and government officials throughout the world. How do you do business with China and not contribute in ways that you don't want to Chinese military strength and play into their national security strategy, which is hostile to us. And this is a gigantic challenge. It's an intellectual challenge. It's a consciousness-raising challenge because we have to get businessmen all over the world to be aware of this and government officials around the world to be aware of this. And one thing I would say is there was a major effort underway by the U.S. government to raise consciousness around the world on the subject. The coronavirus outbreak and all of the supply chain considerations that are now the focus of attention should make it easier, I would hope, for U.S. government officials to make their case that we really need to think very carefully about how we want to do business with China and what kind of dependence we want to have on China for the future.
Yeah, this is a very important point. I just would add as a codicil, one of the other particularly worrying places in which a rethinking is it seems to me, is the practice of our capital markets of investing massively in China and thereby enabling, I'm afraid, quite a bit of the things that we have now to worry about, whether it's the predatory trade practices or economic warfare more generally, or their human rights abuses at home and what they're exporting around the world, and you know, not least their military buildup and the threats that it represents to us. This is a very important insight about the present opportunity as well as the imperative.
One additional point, by the way, Frank, on the point that you just made about investments. A lot of those investments that are coming from all over the world, and the United States included, to China, depend on information from China, you know, financial reports and the like. And one of the things that the coronavirus problem has highlighted is the unreliability of information that comes from China, because the government is, you know, it plays a role and it doesn't tell the truth on. And so I don't think that anybody can reasonably rely on the accuracy of data that we get from China, because the Chinese government manipulate the data for their own political purposes domestically and internationally. And this is something that, you know, that people should be worried about. I mean, in the United States, where we have, you know, much more reliable data, we found in 2008, for example, that a lot of the data that people were relying on for investments in 2007, 2008 turned out to be wrong. Even in a country like ours, which is governed by a rule of law and where there are penalties for misstating, you know, financially relevant data. And in China, the problem is 1,000 times worse. And yet a lot of people rely on data coming out of China as if it's the real thing.
And in this particular instance, I'm so glad you made this point. After the crash of 2008, of course, we instituted some sweeping reforms, Sarbanes-Oxley and other statutes that, you know, established much more comprehensive requirements for transparency and accountability and material risk disclosure and so on, if you're going to be in our capital markets. Only, amazingly, that doesn't apply to Chinese companies, which is a function of apparently the Securities and Exchange Commission simply giving them a pass. This is a formula for disaster, not least, Doug, because as you may know, last year, I believe, a major pharmaceutical, you know, we're big on the problem of depending on Chinese pharmaceuticals at the moment, but a major pharmaceutical company there had $4.4 billion go missing. Quote unquote, go missing. So it speaks very much to your point that this is when you're talking about people's retirement funds in this country, for example, or other life savings being invested willy-nilly in Chinese companies, especially bad ones, doing malevolent things, it's a huge problem. Doug, before we run out of time, I do want to pivot to Iran. You've spent much of your professional life in a variety of capacities in the Defense Department. We worked together for a time in one of those roles. But most recently, as the Undersecretary of Defense for Policy, thinking about and formulating strategies for dealing with the nation of Iran, talk a bit about its present parlous state and what we should be doing vis-a-vis it now.
Well, Iran really is in difficult position because of a combination of factors. Some of them relate to the pandemic. Some of them relate to other natural disasters. There's a locust plague currently afflicting the country, aggravating its problems. And it's really significant. And then there's also the very severe damage that the United States has inflicted on Iran through our sanctions. And a point that's worth stressing is the United States imposed economic sanctions on Iran and increased them substantially when President Trump came into office. And he did it in connection with getting out of the nuclear deal. And lots of people, including, I point out myself, wondered and looked skeptically at how effective those sanctions could be imposed by the United States unilaterally on Iran. And I admit that I was wrong and was amazed about how effective the unilateral U.S. sanctions on Iran could be. The widespread view, and this was virtually the universal view, was that for economic sanctions to be effective, they had to be imposed multilaterally. In other words, we would have to have the cooperation of Japan and the EU and maybe even China and Russia in order to really have effective sanctions on Iran. And that if the United States imposed those sanctions by itself, we might be keeping American companies from doing business with Iran, but we wouldn't be able to keep non-American companies from doing business with Iran. Well, that turns out to be not true. And one of the things we should all note, and it's really a remarkable development, is the unilateral U.S. sanctions, which basically said that anybody who does business with Iran, whether they're an American company or a foreign company, is going to be punished by various means, including lack of access to a banking system. And that has led to a severe drop in business with Iran, even by European countries, companies, where the governments of, in those countries don't support our policy.
And have tried to encourage the companies not to either, and they haven't.
Exactly, but the companies have been unwilling to damage their relations with the U.S. banking system. And so the European companies have been complying with American sanctions, even though their own governments don't support the policy behind the sanctions. And so the U.S. unilateral sanctions have been much more effective than anybody that I know of, you know, predicted.
Well, let me just say I was among those who was actually holding out that it would work. But anyway, Doug, we're out of time. Well, there's so much more to talk about Iran and the Eastern Mediterranean, on which you've been doing some incredibly important work. I hope you'll come back to us again very soon, because this conversation really needs to continue, and I'm sorry we can't do it right now. But thank you for the work you do at the Hudson Institute these days and for your service to our country, my friend. It's been so important and for so many reasons. Keep it up. We'll talk with you soon. Next up, we'll speak with Chris Farrell of Judicial Watch about the latest on Hillary Clinton's email scandal. That and more, straight ahead.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're back. It's a delight to say, joined by one of the leaders of, well, by my lights, one of the most important organizations in Washington, D.C. It's Judicial Watch. And Chris Farrell is its director of investigations. He has a terrific track record, both in the government of the United States, including the uniform of the United States Army, where he was a counterintelligence officer, of conducting and helping the rest of us understand the fruits of really important investigations. And arguably, there's been no more important example of both the vital work of Judicial Watch and the value of its independent ability to pursue truth through its investigations, then the efforts to extract the truth about Hillary Clinton's misconduct in office, in particular her abuse of emails in ways that compromised the national security and violated the law. Chris Farrell, it is always good to have you with us. I understand you've had some interesting developments in that investigation, and I'm anxious to catch up with you about it. Thanks so much for taking a few minutes to join us.
Great to be with you, Frank. So I guess the starting point is the only reason the American public knows about Hillary Clinton's email server at all is because of our litigation, which really is rooted in Benghazi. It's our efforts to uncover what really happened to Benghazi that revealed that Mrs. Clinton was running this outlaw email server that she sent 22 top secret documents across. In pursuing that, and we're now 6 years into the pursuit, Judge Royce Lamberth of the U.S. District Court in D.C. Granted us authority to depose Mrs. Clinton under oath. In other words, our attorneys would sit down in a room with her, place her under oath, ask her questions about that email server, something no one else has done. Not even the FBI got her under oath. And so we move forward with that. We're very pleased Judge Lamberth granted us that authority. About 2 weeks after granting that, her attorneys, and this is really quite remarkable, filed an application for a writ of mandamus. And what that really means in regular normal English is that her attorneys ran to court. They didn't appeal the order. They said this writ of mandamus is really a claim that the judge, Judge Lamberth, acted in some extraordinary, outrageous way simply by granting us the authority to ask her questions under oath. So her position is that she's so important and she's so elite and so...
above the law is the word that comes to my mind.
Yeah, yeah. That she cannot even be questioned. She's above that.
Now, was this writ of mandamus, was it supported to Judge Lamberth or to another court?
It goes to the appellate court in D.C. So, in regular plain terms, it's kind of like an appeal, but it's not in the sense that the foundation for the action is that her attorneys are claiming essentially that Judge Lamberth is out of control.
He would, having had this case before him, as I recall, for most if not all of those 6 years, be entitled to be a little out of control. But this doesn't exactly seem like that's the case. What are the prospects, Chris, that the appeals court of the District of Columbia, which, as I recall, was packed by Obama during his tenure with Democratic judges, might come down on the wrong side on this?
Well, you know, I don't know this for a fact, but it's my opinion that no matter how the case, how this mandamus action is decided, it will be appealed. Certainly, we're convinced that we have a right to ask her questions because she's evaded everyone so far. And we want to get her under oath at answering questions. And so if we win, I'm sure that they will appeal. And in the unlikely or unfortunate event, the appellate court takes up the mandamus and says, yes, she can't possibly be questioned. She's way too important. Well, then certainly we would appeal that. So I kind of deep down inside think this is going to end up in front of the Supreme Court.
This is such an extraordinary story, and I'm so glad you prefaced your remarks by pointing out that none of this would have been in the public domain were it not for your work. And that's all the more extraordinary because not only, as you said, did the FBI not even bother to put her under oath in the course of what, by every light, should have been a criminal investigation, albeit a politicized one which was designed to protect her, as you've demonstrated over the years, Chris Farrell. But the Congress of the United States hasn't gotten to the bottom of any of this either, even though they have had some hearings on Benghazi with her.
What's even more extraordinary is in another related production of documents, we obtained FBI records that showed that in the course of her interview on the 2nd of July, which again wasn't under oath, wasn't recorded.
Had other witnesses to all of this serving as her lawyers as well on top of it. I mean, just unbelievable misconduct, it seems.
Correct, but what was left out of the 302, the FBI report of investigation, and was subsequently captured in other notes that we got, is that she apologized. She apologized to the FBI for what she had done and for taking up so much of their time. That admission, that apology, was left out of the FBI's report of the interview, which is extraordinary.
Extraordinary, and suggests, again, the bias of the Bureau at the time, but also it really implicates her in wrongdoing if she's making apologies for her conduct. Chris, we could go on and on. We're almost out of time. I did want to ask you about one other thing that, again, Judicial Watch has been heroic on, and that is trying to ensure that we're protecting our borders from illegal aliens. And you had a piece the other day calling attention to a very troubling development, and that is the old never letting a crisis go to waste. The open borders crowd is trying to spring all of the illegal aliens that are currently held in custody over concerns about coronavirus. Tell us about that and the public safety as well as public health implications of it.
You know, all the usual suspects are, you know, as you mentioned, you know, leveraging a horrible public health crisis in a remarkably counterintuitive way, saying that all those persons who we don't even really know who they are to begin with, and we certainly don't know their medical histories or records or, in some cases, where they even really came from, you know, that somehow they should all be set free in the public because, if they're held, if they're held in order to identify who they are and actually enact the laws of the country, somehow that's, you know, cruel and inhumane, when just the opposite is true, of course. And I'll tell you that, you know, there's a remarkable number of people coming into the country, or at least attempting to, who are neither Mexican nor from countries of, you know, Honduras, Guatemala, El Salvador, et cetera. I can tell you from my own time in Guatemala, there were, you know, dozens and dozens of people who were coming from other South American countries, from Africa, from Bangladesh. And these are persons that I witnessed their attempts to get into the country.
And when you hear people saying, Chris, well, look, they are at risk of it contracting this coronavirus because they are in confined spaces under this detention policy, you know, there is a certain logic to that. It's just that if you turn them loose in our society, where they don't have any place to shelter in place, presumably, they don't have any place to go other than presumably into sort of public spaces, you are almost certainly exacerbating, as you say, ironically, for people who are expressing concern about the coronavirus, the magnitude of the problem we're facing, no?
It is. It's an exponential risk. It doesn't make sense on a number of fronts. I mean, from a legal perspective, it's crazy, but even from a public health perspective, you know, the risk factors to the general public, the American populace, but even to these people, why in the world would you set loose, you know, essentially free agents to potentially complicate and compromise the situation even worse? It just doesn't make sense.
And unfortunately, this is not a unique example. The whole problem that you've mentioned, Chris Farrell, of people coming in here whose identities and personal histories and so on are unknown, at least for many of them, have raised concerns about the health of our Border Patrol and Customs and Immigration personnel and ICE personnel who have to interact with these folks, whether it's measles or whether it's something else. Chris Farrell, again, my heartfelt thanks to you and your team at Judicial Watch. The work you guys do is incalculably important on a whole host of fronts. I hope people listening to this program join me in thanking you for it and in supporting that work. As we all know, during this period, not-for-profit organizations are in need of that kind of support more than ever. Keep up the good work, my friend. Come back to us again soon. I hope the rest of you will do the same tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Affney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.